content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service and the Associated Press. First of all, an article from the Religion News Service that was published on June 27 and written by Adele M. Banks, entitled "Maryland Church with $100,000 in Vandalism Damage Continues in Faith." The Reverend Jerome Jones Sr. is shocked by two things: the extensive vandalism that took place in his church building in Maryland's capital in early June, and the outpouring of support Fowler United Methodist Church has received in the aftermath. On June 8, the red-carpeted sanctuary of the historically black church was turned into a debris-filled space, with items once sacred ripped apart and an estimated $100,000 in damage. Nothing but paper. It looked like snow around our whole entire sanctuary, said Jones, of pages that were torn from Bibles and from hymnals that had been in the pews, whose upholstery was ripped when a wooden cross was torn down and tossed onto them. When we do our offering, we always lift our hands toward the cross for God to receive our offering, explained the pastor. Since 2021 of the Annapolis Church, founded in 1871. In recent weeks, congregants had to rethink that longtime tradition. I told them the cross is in their hearts. Mark Lemansky, a spokesperson for the Anne Arundel County Police Department, said police are investigating the vandalism and burglary at the church in what is considered by law to be a hate crime. As of midday on June 27, there had been no arrest in the case. "It's just a violation of sanctity," Lemansky said of the incident, described in a news release as significant damage to the church's interior. "I know they're working hard on it." There have been other recent incidents in the area, including an attempted robbery at the Navy Federal Credit Union across the street on June the 2nd, vandalism of a Black Lives Matter sign at a Presbyterian church on June 13, and the stealing of five rainbow-colored plastic hearts from around an LGBTQ plus sign at the same church in May. A suspect has been charged in the latter case. There's nothing to indicate these cases are related. However, detectives are not ruling out anything, Lemansky said. The destruction at the church left some senior congregants fearful to attend the first Sunday after the incident, said Jones, but some returned in subsequent weeks after virtually watching the sermon he preached on Job, the biblical character known for dealing with trials in his life. "We as believers, we can hold on to fear or we can hold on to faith," Jones said, summarizing that sermon. "Fear will grip us and keep us in place, but faith will always move us closer to God. And if we want to continue to move forward, to be a pillar in the community, we have to continue to move toward God." The church had television screens to help older parishioners better see the order of service, since their limited vision made handheld programs hard to read. Those screens, along with one TV that was still in its box, were all damaged, along with all the cords to the church's microphones that were cut. The damage extended to Jones's office, where his academic degrees were broken out of their frames, and the glass on a picture, including images of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, was shattered. The church typically had a Christian flag and an American flag on either side of the front of its sanctuary. They laid the Christian flag down, and they had the American flag pointing up on the podium, said Jones. Images provided by the church show the church's sign outside was also vandalized, with most of its letters on the ground and Reverend Jerome still in place. In the weeks since the attack, Fowler United Methodist, which is working with its insurance company, has received thousands of dollars in donations as well as in-kind gifts to replace damaged items, including a speaker system, Bibles, and hymnals. The Reverend Ben Rigsby, a pastor of the Gathering Faith community, said his United Methodist congregation decided to donate dozens of hymnals to Jones Church. They were still cleaning up the mess, and the choir was rehearsing for Sunday when I arrived, said the pastor of the church in Hanover, about half an hour's drive away. Their resilience was inspiring, and we are glad we could help keep the music going. The Annapolis Church, with about 100 members and about 35 attending on Sundays, is located a few miles away from the Maryland State House. In February, Wes Moore, the state's new governor, preached there on the last Sunday of Black History Month. I am very troubled to learn of the vandalism that has taken place at Fowler United Methodist Church, said Moore, the state's first Black governor, in a statement after the incident. The church is a beautiful and diverse part of the community, and our sacred spaces deserve respect and veneration. I know that Reverend Jerome A. Jones Sr. will reinforce faith and spread goodwill in the community as worshipers continue to cope with this difficult time. The bishop of United Methodist Churches in the region called for solidarity. In light of the vandalism at Fowler United Methodist in Annapolis, I invite all of our congregations to join in intentional and fervent prayer, said Bishop Latrell Easterling in an email to leaders of the Baltimore-Washington Conference. If one of us is under attack, we are all under attack. If one is hurt, we are all hurt. God calls us to pray and to work together to build the beloved community. Jones said he's asking his church members to pray not only to heal their pain, but the pain of whoever's responsible for the vandalism of their building. I ask them to stand in solidarity and let us forgive those who have hurt this church and pray for them, he said. Jones said he has been overwhelmed by the generosity of people of a variety of backgrounds and faiths who have reached out, offering support that has ranged from prayers to money to other kinds of assistance. You had strangers coming, sharing love, who you've never met before, he said. Even in the midst of all the pain and the hate that is in the world, love still conquers all. And at the end of the day, it's all about love. The church had recently worked with community partners, including a local restaurant and nearby hospital, to provide food and toiletries to homeless people. It's in the process, its pastor said, of filling barrels with non-perishable food to send to the children in Africa. In a few months, Jones expects to hand out trophies to participants who arrive on the church property for its car, truck, and bike show. And soon, he hopes, there will be a prayer vigil for the community after the church and its members clean up the signs of the vandalism that struck their building. I've got to make sure, if I do nothing else, I've got to let them know they didn't win, he said of whoever caused the crime. So to do that, we've got to keep moving forward. Next, an article from the Associated Press, published on June the 28th, entitled Parliamentary Inquest into Vatican Girl Mystery Moves Forward as Pope Acknowledges Family's Pain. Rome. Italy's parliament is poised to open a bicameral commission of inquiry into the disappearance of the teenage daughter of a Vatican employee, the third new investigation launched in the four decades since Emanuela Orlandi vanished on the streets of Rome. The Senate's Constitutional Affairs Committee on June 25 unanimously approved setting up the inquest, and full Senate approval is now expected. The Chamber of Deputies, the Italian Parliament's lower house, gave its go-ahead earlier. Separately, Vatican and Rome prosecutors both recently reopened their investigations into the case. Orlandi vanished 40 years ago. On June 22, 1983, after leaving her family's Vatican City apartment to go to a music lesson in Rome, her father was a lay employee of the Holy See. Theories over the years have linked her disappearance at age 15 to everything from the plot to kill St. John Paul II, a financial scandal involving the Vatican Bank, and Rome's criminal underworld. The family and their supporters marked the anniversary with a protest and a march to St. Peter's Square on June the 23rd, calling for the truth about what happened to Orlandi to finally emerge. Pope Francis observed the passage of time during his Sunday noon blessing, issuing a rare papal acknowledgement of the family's enduring pain. These days mark the 40th anniversary of the disappearance of Emanuela Orlandi, Francis said, from his studio overlooking St. Peter's Square to Orlandi's supporters below. I wish on this occasion to express once again my closeness to the family, especially to the mother, and to assure them of my prayers. The lawyer for the Orlandi family, Laura Scrow, applauded the Senate Action Committee action as a good sign and called for speedy approval by the full Senate. The search for truth and justice belongs to all people of goodwill, and today the Senate showed it wants clarity and transparency on the Emanuela case, she said. Scrow earlier praised Francis' decision to speak publicly about the case and to express his solidarity with the family. A taboo has fallen, she said. It wasn't a given, and we are grateful to Pope Francis for this gesture. Popular interest in the case was renewed last year with the four-part Netflix documentary Vatican Girl, which explored the various scenarios suspected in Orlandi's disappearance. The documentary included new testimony from a friend who said Orlandi told her a week before she vanished that a high-ranking Vatican cleric had made sexual advances toward her. After the documentary aired, and with the 40th anniversary of her disappearance nearing, Orlandi's family, with backing from some Italian lawmakers, pressed for a parliamentary commission of inquiry. The Vatican prosecutor recently revealed that he had uncovered, while delving into the cold case files, new leads worthy of further investigation. The prosecutor urged the lawmakers to butt out and let law enforcement do its work, but both houses of parliament nevertheless pressed ahead with their own inquest. The parliamentary inquiry will look into the disappearances of other young women around the same time as Orlandi went missing. The Italian Constitution allows lawmakers and senators to conduct investigations on matters of public interest. They used such inquests in the past to dig deeply into unresolved mafia crimes and terrorist attacks. The inquiries are not meant to replace police investigations, but participating members of the Italian Parliament have the same powers and restrictions as members of law enforcement. Now, an opinion piece that was published by the Religion News Service on June 28, written by Rabbi Mary Zamor, Executive Director of Women's Rabbinic Network. For all the years women rabbis have stood on the bima, as the pulpit in a synagogue is called, we have had to negotiate job searches, contract negotiations, and employment matters using customs and structures built explicitly by and for men. Consider the case of an early career rabbi considering a job offer when she found out she was pregnant. The congregation, she discovered, didn't offer any paid time off. She was left with a terrible choice: disclose her pregnancy, negotiate for better leave conditions, and risk pregnancy discrimination, or say nothing, knowing she couldn't have access to any leave. In either case, what about the other hopeful parents working at this congregation? The rabbi's predicament might have happened anywhere across America's varied religious landscape, as many faith-based employers are only now reckoning with the reality of women's lives. Increasingly, however, houses of worship have begun to employ clergy and staff of all genders, ages, and stages of life. There are more than 700 women and non-binary rabbis of the American Reform Movement alone. High-quality family and medical leave programs are now a necessity. Rabbis understand our roles as moral leaders, modeling and shaping communities rooted in justice, compassion, and care. As employees, we understand that our religious institutions cannot claim moral leadership if we don't provide high-quality paid family and medical leave to everyone who works under our roofs. As women and non-binary people, we understand that this is essential for gender equity in our families, communities, and country. The United States is the only industrialized country in the world without a national paid family and medical leave program. And even those laws guaranteeing rights to employees often don't apply to synagogues, churches, mosques, temples, and other religious organizations. But religious employers are free to set their own moral and practical example to show that organizations of all kinds and sizes stand to gain when we voluntarily implement these programs. That's why the Women's Rabbinic Network, which I lead, partnered with the Center for Parental Leave Leadership to conduct research exploring the experiences of women and non-binary rabbis. Nearly three-quarters of those who responded to our survey had become a parent during their tenure as a rabbi, and almost all of this group took some amount of parental leave. But what happened when they did varied widely, from heartening to heartbreaking. When formal leave policies did exist, they were often unclear and poorly communicated, exacerbating workplace inequity. Often enough, the policy was ad hoc. One rabbi shared that she always believed her congregation offered very poor paid leave until she discovered that senior staff simply took leave whenever they wanted. Employees lower in the organizational hierarchy didn't feel empowered to advocate for themselves and simply didn't get the leave they needed. Sadly, these stories are not uncommon. Others in our study told us that every contract negotiation was a battle, and that they had to forego vacation time, higher salaries, and other benefits to negotiate for family and medical leave. Research consistently shows the benefits for parents, children, and employers when religious institutions provide clear, written, high-quality paid family and medical leave policies to all employees, including during the hiring and recruiting process. These include reduced mortality rates for moms, birthing parents and babies, better health and well-being for children and parents, and improved job satisfaction, employer loyalty, attraction, retention, and performance. Job seekers shouldn't be alone in negotiating paid leave. Neither should individual congregations and organizations be forced to reinvent the wheel. Bringing in expert support and consultation to create policies and aligned practices can be burdensome for small congregations. My organization has developed the Family and Medical Leave Policy Standards for the Jewish community, which provides template policy language that can be used in employee handbooks and employment contracts, educational context, and resources. Our standards set a minimum floor for all congregational and other employers in the Jewish community to provide no fewer than 12 weeks of family and medical leave at 100% pay to all employees, regardless of gender, job role, length of employment, or type of family leave needed. Paid family and medical leave should be a right guaranteed under federal law, without exemption. But there's no reason to wait while we and millions of people from all faith backgrounds across the country advocate for change. Religious institutions in all faith communities are invited to go beyond the requirements of federal law and use our standard or create similar models to ensure that all employees have access to high-quality paid family and medical leave. We may be exempt from some federal laws, but we are not exempt from our responsibilities for the long-term sustainability of our organizations or from our moral imperatives. Our last article is an excerpt from a Religion News Service piece published on June 30 and written by Adele M. Banks, entitled "Smithsonian Folklife Festival on National Mall Explored Often Unfamiliar Spirituality." Washington. In one corner of an array of colorful booths and tents on a hazy day in the nation's capital, Elena Terry prepared to celebrate the beauty of corn through ancestral-inspired dishes like corn crepes on the first day of the annual Smithsonian Folklife Festival. I want to be able to educate people about our life and our connection to food, the land, to each other, and what that means as a Native woman in today's world, said the traditional Ho-Chunk woman from Wisconsin Dells, Wisconsin, in a June 29 interview at the Kitchen Theology Tent on the National Mall. I would like them to understand that we are still here. We do still live our religion daily, and that it isn't something that is structured anything like this other idea of what religion might be, that we are just spiritual people. Terry, the founder and executive of Wild Berries, a nonprofit catering and community outreach organization, is one of dozens of participants featured in the festival's program titled Creative Encounters, Living Religions in the United States. Steps away from her tent were booths about a Hindu temple in Illinois, Arabic calligraphy by a DC artist, and images of santos, or saints, from a New Mexico carver. Michelle Banks, lead curator of the Creative Encounters program, said organizers hope it will give members of the public a chance to pull back the curtain on spiritual practices they know little about, but that may be embraced by their neighbors. One of the things we asked ourselves when we first started looking at this was, how often do people from any religious or spiritual community or tradition visit another place of worship? She said in an interview. We're hoping to start a conversation, she added, expecting some may use the festival as a way to ask this question that I've been curious about but haven't quite been sure how to ask about in the past. The program focuses on key ways faith practices are expressed, from body and spirit, including gestures and dance, to sound religion, including music, stories, and mantras. As she sat for an interview, a bell rang intermittently from a nearby booth of the Hindu Temple of Greater Chicago. Banu Sharma, president of the temple in Lamont, Illinois, later explained that the sound accompanies prayer for priests and devotees alike. When we're praying, it's kind of like we're awakening ourselves, he said. The bell is almost a rhythmic chant while we're singing. It helps, in a way, keep time as well. It's also almost as if we are feeling like we are awakening God to listen to our prayer symbolically. In the first hours of the festival, Sharma said he was learning about the other traditions demonstrated nearby and found connections with lessons being taught by a New Mexico artisan who made carvings of saints using the wood available in his state. It's very similar to the way our artisans carve our deities in India out of marble, and it's just whatever material is available, he said. It's kind of neat that everybody uses what's convenient and what's around them. Nicholas Otera, an Albuquerque teacher and artist, said he views the materials of his artwork as a divine gift. The earth is provided for us, so the paints come from the earth. The wood that we carve comes from the earth, given to us from a greater power, the Creator, said Otero, whose roots are indigenous, Hispanic, and Catholic. That's how I see and believe how I'm able to do what I do. Bob and Ann Wicks of Oxford, Ohio, said the exhibits helped them gain better understanding of traditions practiced around the country through conversations and interactions with the presenters. For me, the most important thing is that these are traditions that are infused with meaning and have religious significance, more spiritual significance within the community. That really helps provide a sense of unity, he said. His wife said they visited a table where they were told to think of your ancestors as they helped make flowers out of colorful tissue paper for the ofrendas, or offerings, for the indigenous holiday, Dia de los Muertos, Day of the Dead. There's a lot of things that we had no idea about on the surface. Oh, it's just a flower and it's just an arch. But actually, it's a lot more, she said. Alec Esparza, one of the East L.A. artists with Mexican roots, was creating the flowers with a Smithsonian intern and volunteer. It's a celebration of life, not how they passed away or died, he said, of the recollection of ancestors. So what we remember is how they lived, and we do that so that we never forget who we are and how they lived. As he spoke to his left, shaped note singers sang the tune often used with the song, Just a Little Talk with Jesus. And to his right, a group demonstrating the work of the Threshold Singers, a hospice music ministry, encircled a woman stretched out before them as they sang gentle music. Arabic calligrapher Josh Bearer describes himself as non-religious, but said his work immerses himself in the sermons and other messages of the Muslim faith. Islamic calligraphy and the religion Islam are intrinsically and forever linked. Without one, there cannot be the other, he said. He pointed to a colorful illustration on display behind him as an example, featuring words from a sermon from an early leader of Shia Muslims and a relative of the Prophet Muhammad. It's ultimately just life advice, how to be a good person in the world, Bearer said, noting that one part of the framed art can be translated to say, one who rejects worldliness is not affected by poverty. We've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News, so please be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The content of this program is also available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.